Hi, I'm Fred Schonenberg, and thank you for joining me on the Venture Fuel podcast. At Venture Fuel, we help companies find new solutions by partnering with the best startups from around the world. On the show, you'll learn the secrets of business leaders who tap into startups and the founders driving extraordinary results. We'll consider new ideas, stretch our mindsets beyond the status quo, and in the process, discover how to leap the competition and fuel personal growth. Hi, everyone, and welcome to a very special episode of the Venture Fuel podcast. I'm your host, Fred Schonenberg. This is part of our live event series titled What's Next Now. This particular event took place on February 25th, and the subject of which was reinventing retail. We've got four panelists on here, each of which is incredibly interesting. Ross Newman is the head of partnerships for Lowe's and their innovation lab. David Matthews, who's a serial entrepreneur, lead investor, and venture capitalist, as well as two startup founders, Ben Conway, who's the co-founder and COO of Ventana, which is the world's first 3D collaboration platform, and Richard Schwartz, who's the president and CEO of Pensa Systems. And Richard is a multiple entrepreneur and quite an interesting guest. I think you'll really enjoy this episode. We talk about what the future of retail looks like, how the pandemic pulled a lot of technology into the future and took what's next and made it now, as well as what's coming down the pipe. What new things have brands and retailers been trying that will stay and hold true for the next 10 years and which are just sort of flash in the pan moments? I hope you enjoy. Let's get after it. Everyone, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate you making time. I think this is going to be a really exciting couple of discussions here. The subject of today is reinventing retail. It's probably the subject I get asked most about at Venture Fuel. And just for those of you that don't know, I'm Fred Schonenberg. I'm the founder of Venture Fuel. We are an independent innovation consultancy based here in New York City. So what does that mean? That means we build innovation programs for established companies, mature industries. And what we're always doing is looking for what's next, but that's applicable today. So very much in the startup collaboration, large enterprise, trying to find ways to break through. And I would say that retail is probably the number one question we get asked about and is one of the industries being most disrupted and with the most opportunity. So today we've got a great agenda. We have four fantastic panelists. And what we've done is we've built in a lot of time for questions from the audience. So please feel free. You'll see at the bottom of the Zoom screen, the chat. All throughout, just pepper any questions that come to mind. I will work those into the conversation. And then at the end, we've also let a little bit of time so that we can do some networking. And the goal there is we want people to get to know each other, the community. Most of the folks on this call are either work at large corporations or they are investors or early stage founders. So I think the conversations will be quite interesting. And that networking piece will be using a new technology called Glimpse, which we'll get to at the end. It's very easy. We'll put a link in the chat and off you go. So I wanted to start off here. You see Ross Newman as well as David Matthews. They're going to be our kickoff panel. So Ross is the head of partnerships for Lowe's Innovation Labs, where he helps Lowe's fast forward the future of home improvement retail by developing new capabilities with startups and the wider global tech ecosystem. Prior to that, Ross worked in media, most recently at Vice, where he ran the emerging social platforms team. And David is a serial entrepreneur. He's also a serial lead investor in emerging investment funds and a venture capitalist. He's launched several successful startups, including Intellicon and Green Mountain Dallas. He also brought the initial capital together to launch several emerging private equity and venture funds, such as Red River Ventures, Elm Creek Partners, Trailblazer Capital, and RevTech Ventures. And with RevTech, he's funded over 40 emerging retail technology innovators to date and had several successful exits. So with all that, the reason we want to get David and Ross together here was we wanted to look at how Ross is pushing innovation from within a big retailer and what David's looking at sort of farther out as an investor, as well as with some of his investments on where things are going. So gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So Ross, maybe I'll start with you. This year, and maybe we'll start with now before we get to next. This year, what nice to haves have become mandatory for retail brands to stay competitive as the world's been disrupted a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I'm certainly here representing the innovation labs at Lowe's, but, you know, just to plug kind of the company as a whole, I mean, the pandemic caused every single part of our business to have to do some really, really meaningful innovation in extremely short order. You know, at the outset, we were labeled as an essential retailer. And so basically overnight, you know, our store operations team and digital teams had to figure out, okay, how do we operate, you know, a Fortune 50 retail business where we have to, you know, be able to count the number of people that are in our stores, like make sure our stores were safe for customers and associates, and do that, you know, in a matter of, you know, days, if not weeks. And so within 24 hours of really lighting up that COVID response plan, you know, our tech team had already built and shipped an app that helped our store managers be able to count the number of people inside the stores. Within weeks, like, our store operations team had stood up a curbside pickup operation that wasn't slated until later, I think about a year, like probably maybe this year as opposed to last year. And so everybody across the company might as well have had innovation in their job description, because everyone's just done an incredible job pushing that forward. On the lens that, you know, we tend to look at, you know, innovation through, what's interesting is that a lot of those nice to haves were already things that we were kind of working on, honestly, just because our time horizon's that, you know, 1, 2, 3 years out. And a lot of the services and experiences that we expected customers to want, you know, became much less as possible features and much more just as like reality today. And so one good example of that is we had been working with a startup based out of Portland called Stream for a few months before the pandemic started. And I had known them for a couple of years before that. And what they had built was a really, really great frictionless video collaboration platform for tools, for pros, that basically allowed pros to insert remotely AR markers into a customer's space and actually guide them through remote fixes and be able to capture information about their home. And so this was a remote service that we're like, yeah, this probably has a lot of applicability, you know, down the road as customers are expecting more and more services to work inside their home. But when the pandemic happened, that became much less of like a nice to have. It's like, all right, well, we actually have to find a way to help our pros keep working, because they literally can't go inside customers' homes right now. And so what COVID caused happened was that entire initiative got accelerated from a small scale POC to a nationwide rollout as part of our Pro Loyalty platform in a matter of months. And in June, we made it a part of that Pro Loyalty offering, so that any Lowe's Pro Loyalty member would be able to use Stream services for free through Lowe's. And we basically white labeled the service to be called Lowe's Pro's Job Site at the end of the day. So for us, you know, some things didn't change too much, but what it did do was it really caused us to go big with a lot of our initiatives much faster than I think we had anticipated.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've heard a lot that sort of everyone all of a sudden had innovation in their title, and everything that was 2 to 3 years out got pulled forward to an immediate, and went from nice to have to like table stakes, which was great for everybody in the innovation space, because it made everything a little more tangible.
Yep.
And then, you know, David, from your perspective, what are you seeing in terms of things that maybe were those farther out wishful bets, right? That all of a sudden became absolute table stakes.
Yeah, I'll just say, you know, kind of everybody did an assessment last year about this time going into the pandemic. And I was generally pleased that our portfolio was really around kind of online growth and automation, personalization, things like that. So most of our portfolio saw a really nice last year, but you kind of immediately start thinking, well, what's next, with kind of some changes that might not be temporary, that might be more permanent in how people live and work and move around. And so, you know, a lot of our thoughts been on that. But one example of something, well, I got to give out shout out to Richard, who's next on the call. How prescient to have a technology for mitigating out of stock on grocery and drugstore shelves. He was very well positioned. But thinking like things that we thought were further out that advanced more, one topic we'd been looking at that went kind of from vision to reality last year was supply chain transparency, utilizing blockchain. And we partnered with a startup out of Rice University in Houston, really got a nice jump on utilization of blockchain beyond the early apps, which are all kind of digital currency related. But the ability to have audit trail in supply chain so that a consumer can see who came from, ensure all these standards like fair labor, organic, green, what have you. The time's really come for that now. And I think it's advancing really quickly. So the consumer's ability to know what they're picking up or buying online or offline, where it came from, exactly the audit trail of the story of that product is really exciting. I think that's coming quick.
Yeah, it's super interesting. And Ross, what on that front, either specifically to that technology or even pivoting from that, thinking through, okay, all your what's next just became now. How do you recalibrate that lens and what are you seeing out there 6 to 18 months?
Yeah, I think in the 6 to 18 months range, certainly from like retail, at a macro perspective, I think it's caused everyone to have a greater appreciation for the fact that retail companies are basically technology companies at this point, or technology companies that happen to have a brick and mortar presence. Our valuation might, you know, in our business model might not be, you know, inextricably tied to a digital product we build, but at the end of the day, you know, nothing, whether it's supply chain or anything, does not work without really world-class technology attached to it. And so it's funny, like there is a blockchain project we're working on, but I'm pretty sure I can't talk about it publicly yet, which bums me out because it would be a really cool thing to be able to kind of go back and forth on. But there are, you know, I think certainly on that side, we are hitting a bit of a cusp now where those use cases and just the concept of blockchain, people have just much greater working knowledge of it. And I think that some of those more day-to-day use cases that can have a real impact are becoming much more apparent to people. And so it's definitely a path that we've been going down. But I think that the technology side of things, it's just opens up the door when you sort of just go through the thought experiment of, okay, well, if Lowe's was a technology company and happened first and a retailer second, what does that kind of company look like? We have a lot of We're very bullish on a lot of the spatial computing capabilities that the iOS LiDAR sensor gives us as an ability to create, you know, true digital twins of customers' homes. And when you can take that as like a given, there's a lot of really interesting home improvement experiences that you can build that just once you sort of see them, you can't really imagine a past where you weren't able to be able to, for example, instantly get measurements right out of your entire space without really trying that hard. So, yeah.
I love that. I also think it's like a great thought experiment for any business in whatever industry to rethink of themselves as a technology business. Mm-hmm. Just to think through the different opportunities that are there and what ways to push it forward. And what about you, David? Are you looking, is the spatial computing space of interest to you? How are you thinking about the physical locations as well as home locations and maybe the AR piece that ties into that?
Well, that tired old phrase called omnichannel, which is really just kind of harmonization to give the consumer a great experience, whether online or offline or a hybrid of both, is pretty well, for the most part, kind of settled out now, I think. I think the next stage is really just that best of class separation for what's best done online and what's best done offline. And for offline, I mean, the things that are really advancing are, you know, store expansion is going to be more and more by small footprint automated stores. We're invested in one of about 8 contenders in the land grab for kind of owning the Amazon Go technology for the rest of the world, if you will. And I think that's really happening, that stores, as they expand, are going to look at expanding that footprint more with automated store technology to get into spaces that weren't practical before, to get closer to that last mile to the consumer. And think, you know, like college campuses, corporate campuses, military bases, things like that. That's one. And then just in the physical store, putting more kind of the power of AI into the humans in the store. Because I don't think AI takes over. I think it's a harmonization between AI and human beings. So things like Theatro that put, you know, the power of the computer in the store associate's ear to be able to better help and educate and give the consumers a great experience. I mean, that's when you're going in a store, it's going to be much more purposeful. When I was a teenager, I worked with a retail concept called merchandise that was basically a demo room out front, a showroom with a micro fulfillment center in the back. And, you know, what's old is new again sometimes. I could see things like that coming back around.
Yeah, what's old again is new again. A lot of people have been telling me about this hot new milkman delivery closed loop business model. And I'm like, yeah, that's been around. The milkman.
That sounds pretty leading edge, huh?
Yeah, exactly. you also just scratch the surface on something really rich that I think the three of us could talk about, which is this, I don't want to call it friction, but you have the store automation, the automated store, right? Smaller footprint, you got it close to the consumer, you can get deliveries faster versus the in-store experience. What's going to actually draw consumers in and let them to, you know, get a deeper relationship with your brand? Curious your thoughts on that as we move forward, knowing right now, like in-store is minimized, but assuming that is going to change. Ross, I'd be curious your thoughts about that sort of dynamic.
Yeah, so we sort of have a twin set of innovation focus areas that hit on this tension between digital and brick and mortar. And so the first one is this idea of tactile e-commerce, right? Which is that thanks to things like AR, there's no reason why an e-commerce experience can't be as tactile as being inside the store itself. And on the other side, we have a theme that's really focused on the idea of the responsive store, which is thanks to being able to create, you know, true digital twins of our store environments, there's no reason why a brick and mortar store can't be as personalized in theory and as digital as an e-commerce experience is. And so what those two things are hitting on is, I think we really believe that there's going to end up being a fusion of those two, where both of those experiences, though discrete, will eventually end up borrowing the best parts of the other experience, the other format. And that's where I think you start really creating some really transformative experiences, because for Lowe's, it's especially important because we sort of have this fundamental context problem we're always trying to solve, which is that when you're in our stores, you have access to the product and expertise that you're ultimately going to want, but it's not in the context that product or expertise needs to be. And when you're at home, you're in the place where the right context, but you don't have access to the product and expertise, and anything the technology can do to bridge that gap makes such a better experience for the customer, whether they're in the store and being able to bring the context of their home with them, or they're at home and being able to bring the store with them into their home. And so I think that's really a big challenge that we're always thinking about. How can we help solve for that, either from a platform perspective or through partnership, you know, with other startups we see in the ecosystem?
Well, thank you, Ross, because the consumer experience online of endless scroll products forever is kind of archaic, right?
Yeah.
And David, what do you think when you're looking out, and obviously you see a ton of different startups and across both sectors, is that what you're looking at as a sort of harmonization between in-store and online, and where, you know, they're blending together to a certain degree, the best of both are coming out on in both destinations?
Yeah, Fred, I'm just always trying to look through the eye of the consumer. I mean, I'm not a big shopper myself, but back in the day, I liked to sit in a shopping mall and just watch consumer behavior and try to understand. But nice thing about retail, it's deregulated, and what the customer wants, the customer gets. So I spend my time just really trying to better understand the consumer. And certainly anytime I'm looking at a new technology or a new innovation, I want to see it through the eyes of a customer, whether that's a business use with a business customer or a consumer use with like a B2B2C approach. But that's what I love about retail is as consumers adopt technology, retail has to adopt technology quickly. Certainly harmonization between online and offline, because we know with these devices, you're shopping online when you're in the store. So that old dread of showrooming that, you know, the customer's going to come in my store and learn everything and then just buy it on Amazon doesn't have to happen anymore. If you have as rich of an online experience as offline.
We could have kept this conversation going with David and Ross for quite some time, because I think what they're getting after here, something that's really valuable, is taking two different innovation streams and harmonizing the two of them together. People talk about, you know, brick and mortar being dead. People talk about omni-channel, or we'll get into this in a moment, but 3D, imagery and how all of this is starting to come together. And the truth of the matter is that all this is going to harmonize. And you're going to see advances in technology in one sector complement advances in technology in the other sector. And I think what David does here that's really smart is to refocus us on the consumer. And the truth of the matter is, as consumers adopt new technologies, that is going to evolve our behavior, both in terms of how we shop and what we demand of retailers and brands alike. So you're going to see harmonizing coming of exponential technologies in multiple fields. This makes it really hard to stay in front of things, because
your competitors are not necessarily the ones that you would expect. They're coming from startups that are somewhere off the grid most likely, and it's this convergence that is really going to drive change.
So I'm going to go to some of the questions in the chat, and you all please feel free to drop them in. We'll get as many answered as we can here. So question for Ross, what is Lowe's current efforts to create 3D models look like?
There's a long answer to this and a short answer. So I'll try to give like a medium answer, I guess. So yeah, 3D content for Lowe's and actually the lab specifically has been kind of a core part of our DNA for quite a while. It was one of the first things that we focused on. And that was born out of a recognition that if we care about building really best-in-class visualization experiences, because you know, if you're trying to get someone to buy a $30,000 kitchen, they should probably know what it looks like. The really hard problem to solve for is not so much the experience itself, but the actual content that you put inside of it. And so for a long time, we put a lot of thought into how to build a scalable 3D content pipeline that basically lets us transform all of the physical product that we sell in our stores into high fidelity 3D that we can push out through whatever visualization channel customers are looking for. So ultimately, our process, without getting in the weeds, is ultimately going to be a bit of a hybrid in the sense that we have some proprietary scanning capabilities that we built in-house, you know, leveraging photogrammetry techniques, but also leverage a lot of hand modeling capacity and other partners to help us increase our throughput on that side of things. The last point I'll make on the 3D model side of things is we're in a weird sort of in-between point where, from a retailer's perspective, right, vendors already provide a lot of the merchandising collateral that we need to be able to put together a product page. We aren't quite yet at a place where those vendors are also coming to the table with 3D models, but eventually that will happen. And eventually we'll get to a place where it's just expected if you're a Lowe's vendor, you know, you need to also provide, in addition to photographs, you need to provide 3D models, because I definitely believe in a future here where just like it would be insane for a vendor to be like, well, no, we don't have products of the photos of the products we sell. It'll be very soon equally insane for them to be like, well, no, we don't have 3D models of anything we sell. And so when that pivot point happens, I think that that's going to be a great thing for us because it makes our life a lot easier to create the content, but also a lot better for just customers in general, especially in the home space, because being able to visualize that in AR in your home just increases customer confidence so much. So.
Yeah, it's great. And I think it's a good one of the next speakers is all around 3D models. Ventana is helping to do that for a lot of brands. So for whoever asked that, stick around. There's some good ones there. And then David, there was a quick question. What was the name of the blockchain supply chain company you mentioned out of Rice?
Yeah, it's called Topol, T-O-P-L. And it's a woman from a diamond mining family out of South Africa leading it that met up with a blockchain team at Rice that were working on an Ethereum project. And she said, hey, how about a project that would be impactful in a brand new frontier?
Love it. This is a good one. We'll see if you can answer this or choose not to, Ross. So did the focus of innovation at Lowe's come with the change in leadership 18 months before the pandemic, or was innovation already a focus of the company? It was. What issues did you face leading innovation at a legacy brick and mortar retailer?
Yeah, so the interesting thing is the focus on innovation, actually, you know, kudos to Lowe's, has been, you know, consistent throughout, you know, the term that we've been around. We've been around for about 6 years as far as a corporate innovation lab goes. It's actually reasonably long, probably not the oldest, but definitely not the youngest by any means. And I think that certainly having Marvin, our CEO, join has, if anything, you know, helped. He's really helped guide the company, both from focusing on the retail fundamentals to also starting to emphasize our new overall strategy, which is this idea of total home, that basically Lowe's should be there to be able to service you for anything you would ever really need when it comes to your home. As far as challenges, you know, that we face certainly, you know, as an innovation lab at Lowe's, but will be mirrored by anyone who works in any corporate innovation lab. Really, the hardest thing to solve for is reducing the friction necessary to help start and create new opportunities and new capabilities. It's not anybody's fault that at big companies there's friction when you do that stuff. Just the reality of, you know, sort of like with great power comes great responsibility. Well, with large size comes great friction. And it just is just the reality of moving a large ship, you know, into a new direction. And so I think for us, you know, just like the inside baseball of innovation, you know, we fortunately have three things that help us operate that any innovation lab should have, which is having our own budget, having our own headcount, and also having buy-in directly into the C-suite, which we do through our chief technology officer, Simontany. And so when you have those three pieces, there's obviously a lot of other details to be worked out, but operationally, it really does help you be able to sort of, you know, chart your own path and gives you a decent chance of making some real change to the company. So,
and David, I love your perspective on that. You have not only had startups that you've had to get into big companies, you've rallied investors from big companies to come into your funds. You've backed companies that then have to work with big companies. Any insights on how to navigate the mothership, so to speak, because everybody at the big company wants to innovate, right? Like everyone's on board to do it, but it's hard when you're that big to figure out where it fits, how, when, and to prioritize it. So would love your point of view on it.
Yeah, it's really, really tough, Fred, with traditional retail brands that have been around for decades. There is a lot of friction, as Ross says, with ingesting new technology. It's ideal when they have, if they own a smaller chain of, you know, like 5 or 10 stores that they could test things in, or have a test store innovation lab, like Lowe's obviously does with Ross's group, to have that path to where you can have a champion kind of navigate the realities of getting new tech ingested into a large enterprise. We've found of late that working with these well-funded digital native brands that have become, you know, expanded into physical spaces, the Warby Parker, Casper's, Bonobos, all those, you know, those online brands, unlike traditional retailers that are used to not knowing the customer until they come to the cash register at the end, these digital native brands really won't tolerate it, because think about it, they're used to knowing where the customer came from, what they clicked on, what went in the basket, what didn't. And when they get in a physical space, they're just not going to tolerate the customer being invisible. That's where, so I find that brands that are expanding quickly, that are well-funded, ingest new tech real quickly.
Cool. Well, guys, you're blowing up here on the chat. So I may screen grab this or Shira, if you don't mind grabbing them, and we'll ask you some questions offline or maybe in the networking piece. But I want to get you out of here with one question. What keeps you up at night? What is the thing that you are thinking about that you want to do that is a challenge that you haven't quite solved yet? And David, I'll start with you.
Yeah, for me, it's all about, you know, what are the next trend lines post-pandemic? You know, what has changed temporarily and what's changed permanently? And just that thought around what is going to be different around how people move about, where they work, where they live, how they do things. That's what keeps me up at night, because it's obviously undergone profound change in a short period of time.
Great. And Ross, what about you?
Yeah, so sort of a similar sort of directional answer, in the sense that I think that what keeps me up a lot at night is really kind of a moving target problem when it comes to innovation, in the sense that even for someone who spends a lot of time being very plugged into the technology ecosystem, the pace at which, you know, new companies are starting and also capabilities are morphing and changing, maybe not necessarily in kind, but in variation, the thing that you thought was the answer 3 months ago, like very well by the end of the year, could be a complete legacy approach. And at the end of the day, like for working for a corporate, you know, the bets that we make, right, are persistent, in the sense that if they are something we roll into the business, it becomes much more difficult to undo and much more difficult to pivot. And so there's a lot of thought and a lot of sort of internal devil's advocacy that's constantly going on, where you're just like, all right, is this the right time to place this particular bet? And does this have, like, is this future-proof enough that, like, it's going to have lasting impact, that I'm not going to have to sort of unwind it, you know, a year or two from now? And so that's really, I think, the thing that keeps me up, is just really always trying to think of, like, what's a founder going to think of on their own and the company they're going to start that's going to obsolesce what I'm doing right now. And that definitely causes me to lose some sleep.
All right. Well, hopefully you'll get some back. And I just want to thank both of you for taking the time to chat. And thank you for also sticking around for the networking. Shira, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you. And thank you, Ross and David. So bringing up our next two panelists, Ben and Richard, as they enable their video. Hi, guys. So we talked to brand, investor. Now we're going to focus on emerging tech and the startups that are actually trying to solve these retail problems. So I will introduce Richard and Ben, and then we'll get right into it. So Ben Conway is co-founder and COO of Ventana, the world's first 3D collaboration platform. The platform unifies and automates 3D workflows, giving teams a centralized place to optimize, share, review, and distribute the 3D models. Some of their clients include brands you might have heard of, like Microsoft, Intel, Adidas, and Nike. And today we're going to talk to Ben about how Ventana and their partners are leveraging 3D for e-commerce. We also have Richard Schwartz here, who is president and CEO of Pensa Systems, a leading innovator in autonomous perception for retail inventory. Richard has previously founded and successfully exited 4 technology venture-backed companies that have been acquired by industry leaders. And today we're going to talk to Richard about how Pensa Systems has deployed across retailers and how it impacts their supply chain and shelf management to optimize product planning, boost revenues, and profitability. So welcome to you both.
Thank you, Sarah.
So one of the first questions I like to ask, basically to any founder, is what is your quick pitch? What is your unique value proposition for your company? And I'll start with Ben to kick us off.
Yeah, sure. So I'm lucky that Ross kind of teed it up. And one of the big things that retailers are looking at is how do we leverage spatial computing, things like augmented reality, to help increase sales, reduce returns. And for that to happen, you need to have 3D models. And there's really 2 ways to go about it. There's manual kind of creation or 3D scanning that happens. But the other way is there's millions of 3D models being generated all the time for manufacturing. The problem is those models are far too large to actually be used in any sort of e-commerce environment, whether it's on the web or augmented reality or some digital showroom. So what we've done is written optimization algorithms that automatically reduce those file sizes by 95% while maintaining super high visual fidelity. So now you're able to take entire catalogs. So for instance, with someone like Adidas, we've taken thousands of shoes, and what took them 6 weeks was done in an hour using our software. So now they're able to deliver those shoes directly into an AR try-on app for customers to experience. So in a nutshell, we help accelerate 3D adoption through a content management system that also automates things like 3D model optimization conversion.
Very interesting. And one thing I want to get to, Ben, in our conversation is knowing kind of a little bit about Ventana in the past, how your business model perhaps has changed sure. to account for this. So we'll get to that in a minute. Looking at Richard now for your unique value proposition. And if folks haven't seen a video yet of your technology, I encourage you all to check it out.
Yeah, thanks, Shira. We go after the problem for both the brands of the retailer. How do they know what's actually on the shelf and available for sale? And how do they minimize stockouts for everyone's benefit? And that's about a $1 trillion problem even before COVID. There's no system of record for knowing that today. It's very eyeball intensive with people walking around and trying to stare at everything. There's automation for many other things, but not that. And we solve that problem by training the computer to stare at the retail shelves and what's there, essentially use computer vision and our own flavor of AI to visually be able to recognize what's on the shelf and available for sale down to the item or the SKU level. And also by looking repeatedly, figure out how the shelves are being arranged or organized. And from that, we can score and read out essentially in real time what's out of stock, what's running low, what's misplaced, and so forth, providing that data for both the retailers as well as the brands that sell through them.
Very interesting. So one of the questions that, you know, I'm always talking to startups about is the last year has been a bit nuts in terms of the transformation of various areas, especially retail. And so a lot of startups have had to pivot, or basically they've identified new customers, new clients for their technology. So Ben, I'm curious to hear a little bit of the story of when Ventana started realizing that these 3D models for your clients were going to help with the commercialization and retail needs, and kind of how that's going for your current clients in terms of helping their customers have a better experience, their shoppers.
Yeah, sure. So for a little background on this, we actually started out doing holograms. So if you had ever seen like Tupac at Coachella or anything like that, we had built a better mousetrap essentially. And then we added a lot of interactivity in it. So we were using game engines like Unity to build these interactive experiences. So we'd build like a hologram car configurator for Lexus, or you could fly a drone for DJI. And what would happen is these brands would provide 3D models of their products. And then we'd get them and we'd be like, oh my God, we got to spend a week or two manually like optimizing this file, meaning like reducing geometry you don't need, compressing texture, stuff like that. And we're like, there's got to be a better way to do it. And we kept looking, and there's no automation really at all that made any sense. And so
we thought, well, maybe we could get involved there. And we realized that it actually, we hit on a much, much bigger problem than anything that we were working on. So that was probably 2.5 or 3 years ago that we first started having the idea. And then we've kind of been at it full bore for the last 2 years or so. And it's been really interesting. And it's something that we're very excited about. Also going from something that was a little bit more services driven, that you were kind of constantly trying to figure out how do you make this more recurring, to now what is just SaaS software. It makes life a lot easier in some ways. And then once you sign up a customer, they're consistently your customer. But it's a problem that we're glad we switched to. And our timing was very fortuitous, I guess, in that we made this transition, closed our Series A the end of October of 2019. So,
good timing.
Yeah, it was very good timing. It was very good timing.
And Richard, for Pensa Systems, so you know, I know you explained this a bit, but how does your technology help your clients serve their shoppers? And has that changed at all from pre-pandemic to kind of where we are right now?
Yeah, it's changed quite a bit, Shira. Almost overnight, all the rules changed. And it's forced the retailers and the brands to rethink how they understand who the shopper is, what they buy, where they shop, when they shop. And of course, almost day over day and week over week, there were massive changes in also what products were available and the directions to the brand manufacturers for what to surge in production changed. And the only constant through all of that is understanding what you actually have available on hand and what things are available and how that changes week over week. And it's really caused an acceleration of what we're doing. And the need for what we're providing is kind of a truth for what's really happening on the shelf.
Yeah, most certainly. The next question I have for you, and by the way, for those attendees, feel free to drop your questions into the chat or the Q&A and we'll get them to Richard and Ben. But the next question I have is really about thinking into the future. And I know a lot of the conversations we have are about what will life look like, the new normal post-pandemic, whenever that happens. And so from your perspective, I'm curious, what changes do you anticipate in the consumer behavior as we get kind of through the pandemic to the new normal? Perhaps, Ben, you can start us off.
Sure. I mean, I think that I don't have a super novel perspective. I think people are just getting more and more comfortable with digital, and the brands are getting, I think, frankly, there's more reticence on the brand side. We do a lot in apparel, footwear, accessories. And so I think there's less on the consumer and more on the brands that are kind of afraid to change and move things. We saw an acceleration for sure, because traditionally the way it works for like apparel is you produce the samples and then you put together a showroom, and there's these big meetings that happen a few times a year, and that, you know, all went to hell in a handbasket with this. But the brands that had 3D were actually able to showcase a lot of their assets and change the way that things are working. Our customers like Adidas, who have deployed things like shoe try-on being their mobile app, or just shoe product placement, have seen massive increases in sales. And so I think we're going to continue to see that. But I think the question that brands need to be asking themselves as they're looking to adopt this new technology is not, does this replicate my experience? Does this 3D model look exactly the same way that a product looks in person? I think it's, does this help me increase sales and reduce returns? Because I think there's a bigger willingness than ever on the customer's part to try something new, to engage with something different. They understand the game has changed. Mm-hmm. I think some of the brands that don't.
Yeah, it's a great point. It's almost like as the world is changing, and the consumers are wanting to change, they're open to a new experience. Brands need to latch onto that now. And in many ways, they do that through emerging technology like your own. And then Richard, from your perspective, I mean, we've already seen a lot change, and you mentioned that everything, all the rules are changing rapidly, but what do you see in terms of the consumer or even some of your clients' experiences as we emerge out of the pandemic?
Yeah, so we have a primary focus on grocery and drug. So it's like the eye of the storm, right? It's exactly where all the changes and transformations are occurring. One of the things that's happening there is it's accelerated online or e-commerce or the omni-channel by years and years, which will never go backwards. All of a sudden, a large part of the way people are buying their groceries and other things is online, and it's put a lot of pressure for things like buy online and pick up in store, or the Instacarts and the DoorDashes of the world for delivery. Because somebody is buying online, they're making choices. They don't know what's actually out of stock or available for later, when mm-hmm. some random person is going to grab something and then deliver it to them. And it produces all kinds of disappointments for everyone. The basket substitutions when the products aren't actually available and it's not the consumer that's going to make a choice, right? What's available for the consumer when they're buying online is wrong. And everyone is forced to readjust that. For the brands, it also means that the behavior is all different. Knowing what people do, what they buy instead, all of those behavioral rules are different. So everything about inventory accuracy, everything about consumer choices and behavior, and forcing the retailer and the brands and delivery partners to get a lot better all of a sudden at this blend of e-commerce and shopping in store is a huge stress on the entire system. And it's like, grow up fast. And we're helping with that kind of thing from our standpoint.
Yeah, that actually is a similar point to one of the questions we have in the chat right now, which is for Richard. How do you balance the disparate goals of brands and retailers? They are notoriously not great at sharing data.
So, of course, that's true to some extent. And yet there's a strong heritage of each needing the other very deeply. So point of sale data or cash register data is being used back and forth. The notion of category management, or how do you know what should be put on the shelf and how to allocate different parts, those are long-standing relationships between the two parties. And even more now, Shira, there are immediate urgent conversations from the retailers out, particularly to their largest brand manufacturers, asking them to surge in production for certain SKUs, maybe kind of a back to the future to be able to produce more of the comfort of the tried and true products. It's on allocation. So how do you know it's actually making it to the shelf? So more than any other time in history, there's a very strong interdependency between the two. And they both have the same goal. Get the products that matter on the shelf. Use the shelf wisely and don't disappoint the customer any more than absolutely necessary, you know?
Yeah, it's a true partnership. A couple quick questions for Ben. Do you have any data around sales lift around brands that have 3D models versus those that just use static images?
Yeah, so Shopify published a study that's pretty widely quoted where they're seeing their merchants who are using 3D models are increasing sales by 200% relative to merchants that are not, and reducing returns by up to 40%. The reality is it's super product specific. I think some things really lend themselves well to it, and I think some things don't. For instance, I had a conversation today where someone was very interested in getting cheese and olives to 3D, and I was like, we could do it. I don't have any data for you there. Right. But I think, like, to Ross's point earlier about appliances, home furnishings, like IKEA, Wayfair, House, those companies are investing, like Wayfair brute force, like hundreds of artists right now, because it's such a big mover of, like, it has really moved the needle for them in terms of conversion rates that they actually have, like, whole teams, not even like outsourced to, they've got some in India, some in China, but like US-based teams to create 3D versions of furniture because they find that it increases conversion so much. So it's worth it for them to someone manually create this model of it, even when they don't have it for manufacturing. So this is like just a, like, hey, we know we don't have the manufacturing data, but we're going to go ahead and create it anyway. So for certain categories, it makes a ton of sense. Frankly, there aren't enough categories that are tested yet to really see what's the strongest, but I think furniture is one of them.
Yeah, well, because it's so strong, another question for you from the chat. How much time before you think all brands adopt 3D models for e-commerce?
I think that one of the big drivers for this is going to be, like, you've seen every major tech company invest hundreds of millions, if not billions, into 3D. I mean, Unity, the game engine that just went public and its market cap's $37 billion is Unity 3D. 3D is actually like a part of their name. You've got Amazon investing a bunch of money. Everything that Apple's doing with their new headset, Microsoft HoloLens, all that requires like 3D content. So that's kind of pushing the industry. One of the big barriers is number one, creation, and there's some scanning solutions that are being created right now that might help solve some of that gap. And the second thing that's happening is we're waiting for online, like real-time web rendering capabilities to improve. And again, you've got industry groups working on that. So I think that in the next 24 months, you're going to start seeing this be much, much more standard with certain industries adopting it faster than others. I think we'll start seeing it also earlier in the value chain. Like B2B is like actually a place to unlock this. Like everyone thinks consumers, but think about equipment sales. Think about like selling a tractor. It'd be pretty helpful to see that in augmented reality before you buy, and people are not traveling as much. So
yeah, definitely.
For all you founders out there, as well as innovators at large companies, listen up to this next section. Ben and Richard basically break down the value of startup and enterprise collaborations, as well as the challenges that are there. The importance of why Venture Fuel exists is to marry these two together. And I think both of them do an excellent job here of framing up the advantages to both the large and the emerging companies.
Okay, last question. We'll do a little bit of a rapid fire last question for you both. And in the previous conversation, I think Ross alluded to this in terms of his work with startups, and Fred as well as David mentioned it. But one of the big things that we do at Venture Fuel is connect big corporates to startups to move quicker, to be more innovative. So my question to you both is, why should large companies look to work with emerging startups like yourselves? And I'll start with Richard for the first answer.
So I've been on both sides of the fence, Shira, right? As you noted, I've started and sold four in the past, and I've been sort of on the other side in charge of M&A and partnerships from the big side. You know, very often, particularly venture capital-backed companies can have novel solutions that, as long as the companies are well-backed and or well-partnered with larger business development partnerships, you can get almost several years of advanced head start and look by carefully partnering. Then both for the large company, being careful not to overwhelm the smaller company, and vice versa, that's something that has to be carefully watched from both sides.
Great point. What about you, Ben? Anything you'd add to that answer?
I think being a smaller company, you have a lot of latitude to look at a lot of different things. Like one of the things you find working with enterprises is that if it's not their biggest burning fire, if it's not on like, hey, this is your quarterly objective, then teams don't look at it. Even if they're innovation teams, even if they're like people that are supposed to be experts on the space, one of the things that, you know, we see that we have a really unique perspective on is that we can very quickly talk to companies that are working in manufacturing industry, apparel, using a bunch of different software, footwear, et cetera. And all of a sudden now we have this massive knowledge base that big companies don't have access to because they're often so siloed or so looking at this in a very specific way. And we have a much broader 30,000 foot view, and that's provided a lot of value. And I think that startups often have that because they have the flexibility to explore a lot more. So they end up becoming broader industry experts than people at larger corporations sometimes can.
Yeah, great point. Not only are smaller companies like yours closer to the consumer, but also closer to other industries because they're working across a variety of different clients. So with that, I want to thank you both for spending time with us today. Really great conversation.
Thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate you taking the time. I hope you enjoyed this special episode. If you want to know more about our event series, What's Next Is Now, just go to LinkedIn at Venture Fuel. We're always posting about the upcoming events coming. Next month, we actually will have our Rogue Women series featuring women founders, women funders, and women executives. It is a fantastic series and probably our most popular series. It'll be the last Thursday in March. So be on the lookout for that. But check us out, Venture Fuel at LinkedIn. Thanks so much.